veces te engaña, el amor es pureza. Si es que alguien tú amas, el amor te atrapa y de nunca escaparás. Solo tienes que aprender a amar, amar. El amor es una magia, una simple fantasía. Es como un sueño y al fin lo encontré. Es como una luz por el alma y recorre como el agua hasta que llena el corazón.
AMS Food Bank. Your access to money during the studies at UBC will most likely be limited, but it is a priority of the AMS Food Bank to ensure your access to food is not. The AMS Food Bank provides emergency food relief 7 days a week for all UBC students. To volunteer with the food bank or for inquiries about how to take advantage of the services provided, contact them at foodbank@ams.ubc.ca. For more information, find the AMS Food Bank on Facebook or feel free to visit anytime across from the Wellness Center and Sprouts.
Listen, if they're so hot, how come they're not tearing up the charts, babe?
Because you never play them, babe.
At CITR, our hosts choose the music they play. That means our charts actually reflect the tastes of music lovers, as opposed to focus groups. So if you want to know what's really tearing up the charts, get your hands on a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or go online to CITR.ca. CITR's charts are based on actual spins motivated by actual preference. No payola, no marketing, just good tunes. Refreshing, no?
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us?
Welcome to News 101. Today is Monday, October 15th. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver to the UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It is 5:06 p.m. and time for another almost full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. Today, we have two news reports from our correspondent, Najin Razian. We'll also be bringing you our regular segments in Simply Science. Sarah Chow and her guests, Megan and Martha, are talking about their investigative video on science communication. In Dietetic Intuition, our health team talks about cardiovascular disease.
All this plus your weekday weather forecast brought to you by the UBC Storm Club right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And now for your UBC campus and local headlines.
We now give you an update on the job action occurring on the UBC campus. Last week on Wednesday, the UBC newspaper reported that UBC has reached a tentative agreement with QP2950, the union that represents library and clerical workers on campus. The union has scheduled a strike vote for October 25th, but that meeting will now be used as a vote to ratify the collective agreement. The tentative agreement includes a 2% wage increase backdated to April 1st, 2012, and another 2% wage increase on April 1st, 2013. On Thursday, job action on campus continued to intensify for the QP116 Service and Support Union, which began limited job action on October 4th, and which represents more than 2,000 employees in trades, food services, student housing, parking, research labs, and more. Custodial and trade staff walked off the job, an overtime ban was enacted, and a dental clinic shut down for the latter half of the day. Pickets of the General Services Administration Building, which houses UBC parking offices, continued. Also on that day, the Nobel BioCare Dental Clinic on campus was also shut down at midday when all QP116 staff walked off the job. Friday morning, members of QP116 formed a picket line at the entrance to the Commons Block in the Thunderbird residence, which houses administrative offices. The picket line ran from West Mall to Thunderbird Boulevard, circling the Thunderbird residence and Student Housing and Hospitality Services offices. QP116 has said they want their job action to have as little impact on students as possible. Today, the university warned that job action could escalate. QP116 continued its limited job action with withdrawal of landscaping, waste management, and recycling crews. The lost and found office at the campus security office is also closed today.
On Thursday, Conservative MP Alice Wong... of Richmond issued an invitation to Asian media outlets to a press conference in which she ate shark fin soup. The move was seen as controversial, as there is currently a push from the city of Vancouver to place a regional ban on shark fin soup. The move comes after the NDP pointed to a 2009 study showing that more than a third of all shark species are threatened with extinction as a result of shark fin fishing. However, Wong stated that the issue isn't a federal one and not a municipal one, and has accused the NDP of ignoring the concerns of the Chinese community and businesses. In a statement released on Thursday, Alice Wong said, quote, "If a product such as shark fin is derived from a legal, humane, and sustainable harvest, we see no basis to restrict its trade," end quote. Exactly why English news outlets were not invited to Thursday's press conference has not been clarified.
Former Vancouver City Councillor Suzanne Anton has announced that she'll be seeking the BC Liberal nomination in early 2013 for the Vancouver-Kilchena riding. The riding includes the Musqueam territory south of the University Endowment lands, as well as residential areas bordered by 16th Avenue to the north and Granville Street to the east. The seat is currently held by Finance Minister Colin Hanson, who will not be seeking re-election, but Anton will be vying against former Liberal Party President Andrew Wilkinson for the nomination. Anton served on Vancouver City Council from 2011, but lost the mayoral election to incumbent Gregor Robertson by almost 20,000 votes in 2011. This represents her first foray into provincial politics.
A British Columbia lawyer has entered the leadership race for the Liberal Party of Canada. Alex Burton is Crown Prosecutor for the British Columbia Ministry of Attorney General in the Organized Crime Unit, but is a newcomer to running in federal politics. However, critics wonder whether Burton will be able to gain the momentum needed to challenge Papineau MP Justin Trudeau, who has a significantly longer history in politics. Key points from Burton include rebranding the Liberal Party and increasing transparency in government. The Liberal Leadership Convention will take place in April 2013.
And those are your UBC campus and local headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but stay tuned for some of your local news segments.
Hot hack, I'm gonna tearing up the charts, babe.
Because you never play them, babe.
At CITR, our hosts choose the music they play. That means our charts actually reflect the tastes of music lovers, as opposed to focus groups. So if you want to know what's really tearing up the charts, get your hands on a copy of Beatroot, or Discorder magazine, or go online to CITR.ca. CITR's charts are based on actual spins motivated by actual preference. No payola, no marketing, just good tunes. Refreshing, no? Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the commercial drive area at
Audio Pile, Bone Rattle Music, High Life Records, and the People's Co-op Bookstore.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at CITR.ca.
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. It's now time for our local news stories with our correspondent, Nagin.
The following is a story I wrote for Van City Buzz, titled, Bellingham Airport Announces Plans for New Hotel. Business at Bellingham Airport has tripled over the last 5 years, since the airport began offering flights to Hawaii. Now, Bellingham is expanding past Costco, and the Bellingham Airport is looking to take an even larger chunk of BC's air travelers by announcing plans for a new hotel. Port of Bellingham Real Estate Development Manager Shirley McFerrin says the city plans on building a 150-room hotel, along with a restaurant and meeting room space. However, they're going to let the market drive the actual development. She adds that the hotel will be right at the Bellingham International Airport, so close that a traveler can walk from the hotel to the terminal. She says the airport is accepting proposals until the end of the month. McFerrin hopes construction will begin by the end of 2013. Nagin Resian, CITR 101.9. The following is a story I wrote for Van City Buzz, titled BC Ferries Fares to Increase Over the Next Few Years. Bad news for Vancouver Island residents and visitors. Fares will increase an average of 4% each year over the next 3 years. The independent regulator for the ferry service approved a target aimed at BC Ferries to find more than $54 million in efficiencies, including service cuts. BC Ferry Commissioner Gord McAtee says an increase of 4.1% is set for April 1, 2013, followed by a 4% increase in April 2014 and a 3.9% increase in April 2015. McAtee is responsible for setting and enforcing the fare cap, which permits fares to increase and decrease depending on fuel costs. The Coastal Ferry Act, passed by the Liberal government last spring, provides BC Ferries with $80 million to keep fares in check. However, the legislation seeks $30 million in service cuts. BC Ferries' year-end financial report included losses of over $16 million. Vehicle traffic was at a 13-year low, and BC Ferries counted the fewest number of passengers in 21 years. Nagin Resian, CITR 101.9.
Thank you to Nagin for those stories. It is now time for our weekly weather forecast with our very own Phil Chang. Hi, Phil.
Hi. Sounds of thunder outside the sub as we speak, and the upper air soundings at the Vancouver airport have very tight temperature and dew point lines, so it appears, yes, we're going to get a bit of precipitation sometime within the remainder of today. Our rooftop weather station is predicting 15 millimeters, about half of what we received this past Sunday. But looking on the bright side, we're more than halfway past the low-pressure system cell now. And according to University of Washington's MMFOT loop, in about 30 hours, we should have a small high-pressure bridge build up to the next of us. So a bit of calm is what we're expecting on Wednesday. Something to look forward to. Now, here is Environment Canada's forecast for this week. Tonight, Rain ending early this evening, then cloudy with 40% chance of showers. Risk of thunderstorms and winds of southeast 40 to 60 kilometers per hour, turning towards southwest. Late this evening, then west 50 degrees, gusting to 70 overnight. Low of 9. Tuesday, mainly cloudy, 40% chance of showers in the morning. Wind west 50 kilometers per hour, gusting to 70, then diminishing to 30 late in the morning. High of 14. Tuesday night, partly cloudy, windy in the evening. Low of 8. Wednesday, cloudy, with 30% chance of showers, high of 13. Thursday, rain, low of 8, high of 12. And Friday, cloudy with 60% chance of showers, low of 10, high of 11. Okay, so those are your weather forecasts for the coming week by Environment Canada, as well as the UBC Storm Club. I'm Phil Chang, you're listening to News 101.
Thank you, Phil, for that weather forecast. And it's now time for Simply Science with Sarah Chow.
This is Simply Science, bringing you your science news. I'm Sarah Chow. This week, we have a special edition of Simply Science. Joining me in the studio today are Megan Callahan and Martha Isak. Both are science graduate students here at UBC, as well as science storytellers. Megan and Martha are here today because the video they produced, directed, and shot, along with Colin Mahoney and Yoshi Watanabe, got picked up by the New York Times blog and mentioned in USA Today. Here's an audio clip from their video.
Hey, did you hear how there's all these species that are going extinct due to habitat loss? It's really sad.
Yeah, but there are millions of species. What do a few matter anyway?
Thank you, Megan and Martha, for joining us today. So, because this is radio, can you please describe the video to our listeners?
I guess just in short, our video is kind of a 1 minute. It was set up as sort of a Mythbuster-esque theme. Where basically our myth is the sense that it's okay if a few species go extinct, there's millions out there, and we wanted to kind of indicate this for this kind of domino effect or this interconnectedness of all the species using a bunch of dominoes falling over and eventually affecting all species, including humans as well.
So this video came out of a video production workshop that took place right here at UBC. Can you tell us a little bit about the workshop and how you found out about it?
So the video workshop was put on by a couple of different groups, including TerraWeb, which I'm actually a member of. And it brought in Randy Olson, who's a filmmaker. And it was a 3-day intensive workshop where basically we learned everything from how to write a script to how to edit and how to put a video together, one that's focused on science and trying to communicate that science to a more general audience.
So Randy Olson is scientist turned filmmaker. What was it like to work with someone so big?
I'd actually met Randy in March, I believe. He was here for a TerraWeb seminar then. I've worked with other filmmakers from National Geographic, and I think Randy definitely had a different style, much more Hollywood, much more broad audience, whereas some of the people I've worked with have been geared more towards an audience that's already interested in science.
Where did you get the idea for the video?
That was me. I mean, in all my work, I've really kind of been interested in animal-human interactions and relationships. And when Randy suggested kind of this, you know, Mythbuster, I was looking for something that sort of had to do with that. But that being said, you know, the group as a whole definitely helped shape and create this project. You know, we talked about it, and we even had whole class meetings where the whole class got to talk about it and give their suggestions. And so it really came together as a group project.
Yeah, so Megan's idea started out with somebody sitting at a table, and then there's a semicircle of dominoes around them. And, I mean, that's not what happened in the video. Instead, the dominoes, someone knocks them down. They go out the door. They go into the forest, into streams, like, across bridges and, like, on the ice. So we definitely, like, took your idea. I'm not sure, like, whose suggestion it was for things to be outside, but it just kind of happened when we were discussing it.
Might have been Collins to give him full credit. But yes, I was thinking nice and easy, and we didn't take the easy route, but I think that was a good decision.
Yeah.
Did you come across any problems putting up the dominoes?
Oh, yes.
We have bloopers that, like, Colin's swearing about it.
Yeah, I mean, basically, they fall down when you don't want them to fall down, or then you try to knock them down, and they get halfway and stop. And it was a long, long process.
Oh, yeah.
So both of you are science graduate students doing research and all that. So what got each of you interested in science video production?
Well, for me, it was something incredibly new. And that's why I kind of like this TerraWeb, is it's looking at a whole different range of ways of communication. And I'd never actually done a video production workshop, I think, which is kind of the opposite of what Martha had been there. But I thought it was a great experience.
Yeah, I'd done a bit of video stuff before. So right after I finished my undergrad, I did two courses at the Banfield Marine Sciences Center, one in science journalism and the other in scientific filmmaking. And so I'd done some filmmaking. It was mainly teaching us about techniques and then learning how to put together a documentary and tell a story. So for me, I really wanted to push myself to learn to use different editing software. So the group was lucky, and I was really glad that the group let me be the editor so that I could learn how to use the software and, you know, just improve my skills with that.
The group was very glad you were the editor.
I didn't sleep much.
So how did you guys react when you found out that the New York Times and USA Today picked up your video? How did you find out?
I guess it was through an email. Was the first TerraWeb sent us out some emails about it. I think I had to go check it immediately because I was like, is this right? Are you sure about this? It was pretty amazing. I was not expecting that coming out of that workshop.
Yeah, it was pretty exciting. It was also exciting to hear that Randy thought our group had really come together, because I thought it was a really positive group experience.
Oh, yeah.
I think, you know, sometimes you work in a group and then there's one person who's kind of, like, not with it, but everyone was really with it and really committed to making it work.
Yeah.
And so it was a really positive experience, and it's really nice that we were sort of able to share and extend that positive experience with other people.
Why do you think film is a good media for science communication?
I think video is a great way to communicate science, especially to the public. A lot of the scientists I know, the reason why they got into science was from watching films. So without David Attenborough and BBC Nature films, I probably wouldn't be a scientist. And so I think it's a really great way to engage people. I think writing about science is fantastic, but one of the problems is that people who aren't interested in science might not go to the effort to read something about science. So video's nice because you can sit back and watch, and it takes a lot more effort on the part of the people producing the video to come up with something that will engage people. But I think you can really get through to more than just their mind. It gets the audience not just thinking about science, but feeling something towards it and feeling a connection towards nature or whatever scientific topic you're talking about.
So as scientists and science graduate students, do you think science communication is important?
I think science communication is incredibly important because, you know, as scientists, many really want to let people know what they're doing, to make a change, to make a difference. And in order to do that, people need to know what they're doing. And, you know, with all these new forms of communication, you know, it's making movies, pretty much everything, you know, all these new things that we haven't even discovered or developed yet. It's just really great opportunities to get people's message out there and for scientists to really attempt to, you know, make this change or make a difference.
So personally, I think scientists have an obligation to communicate the results of their research to the public. Most science is publicly funded. And so I think it's important for scientists to, you know, communicate the results back to the public and justify why it is that we have scientists, why we pay them. And with current funding cuts to science, I think that's even more important these days.
So what's next for both of you? Future Hollywood directors, filmmakers?
Oh, dear.
I would love a job at National Geographic. If they want to give me a job film editing, I will move anywhere. And while I've been working on my thesis, I've also been making videos about the research that I do. And so I study song sparrows, and I'm working on a documentary about why, even though song sparrows aren't endangered, we still actually have spent a lot of time and energy studying them. And so we've actually learned some things from them that teach us about conservation research, even though they aren't endangered. And so the documentary that I'm working on is about the long-term research project that I am currently part of.
And where can we expect to see this documentary?
I'm not sure, I guess. I'm going to work on figuring that out in the next little while.
Cool.
For me, it's mostly thesis is the...
Oh, gosh.
The future step.
I should really do that.
I know, I'm thinking like tiny little bit.
All right, once I finish my thesis.
There we go. Then we can move on.
All right. Well, thank you, ladies, for coming out and sharing your story with us today. And if you'd like to check out their video, please check out the CITR Facebook page. Well, that's it for this week for Simply Science. For CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, British Columbia, I'm Sarah Chow.
And thank you to Sarah Chow for getting us that segment and that interview with Megan and Martha, who are grad students here at UBC. Once again, you can listen to that interview on our website, citr.ca/news. And now we go to our health segment, brought to you by Dietetic Intuition. This week, it's on cardiovascular disease.
Welcome to your weekly health beat on CITR 101.9 FM.
It's Dietetic Intuition, your source for precise nutrition advice.
What are you going to hear? We'll bust nutrition myths, give tips, do book reviews, as well as interviews, you name it. And now here are your dietetic students, Andrea, Jessica, and Sharon, for this week's segment.
Hi, everyone. It's Andrea here. Thanks for tuning in on this Monday afternoon. We have some quick updates for you. We have joining us today one of our fellow dietetic interns at Vancouver Coastal Health, and she's joining us for the first time. Please welcome Lauren to Dietetics Intuition. Now, if you're wondering if where Jess is gone, she's not completely gone. She'll be here for guest segments. She's just moved to Vancouver Island to finish the last year of her program, so Lauren will be helping us regularly to cover that until she's back. Now, I'll pass it off to Lauren, who will be talking to you about the topic of the day.
Thanks for the introduction, Andrea. I'm really excited to be joining you guys. The topic of today is cardiovascular disease. Yesterday was World Heart Day, so today we'll be discussing what cardiovascular disease is, how it can be prevented, and how you can manage your symptoms so that you can live a heart-healthy life. Cardiovascular disease is a group of diseases, actually, that affects the function of the heart or the blood vessels that supply the heart. Common causes include hypertension and atherosclerosis, which is the hardening and narrowing of arteries. It is the leading cause of death in the developed world, and it affects all ages, genders, and races, so unfortunately, none of us can hide from it. Who gets cardiovascular disease? It's a common myth that only the elderly get CVD, because people are showing signs and symptoms younger and younger these days. But if you're wondering what puts you at a higher chance of getting CVD, some of the risk factors that you may want to look out for in yourself or in your loved ones include obesity, and in particular, abdominal obesity, so obesity around your middle, smoking, alcohol use, a poor diet, which we would consider to be high in fat, sugar, and salt, an inactive lifestyle, and high blood pressure. Andrea is now going to tell us all about preventative measures that we can take to prevent CVD and why you may need to bust out that measuring tape.
Thanks very much, Lauren. So what can you do to prevent cardiovascular disease? The main method for doing this is to manage your risk factors. Now, you can choose to work on any of the risk factors that Lauren mentioned earlier, of course, but we recommend the following three. We believe that eating healthy, exercising daily, and avoiding smoking will have the greatest impact on increasing your cardiovascular health. As dietetics interns, we will focus more on the risk factors that you can manage with nutrition, of course. And that's eating healthier, decreasing any abdominal obesity you may have, and lowering your blood pressure. Working through them one by one, let's start with eating healthy first. Now, we recommend the DASH diet as a way to prevent cardiovascular disease. DASH stands for Dietary Approaches to Stopping Hypertension, and you can Google it for more information. But just to give you a quick breakdown on what it is, it's recommended by the U.S. National Institutes of Health as an ideal eating plan for preventing chronic disease such as CVD. It's also been backed by a lot of research, so it's quite effective. And more information on what it actually is, it's high in whole grains, high in fruits and vegetables, high in low-fat dairy products, high in lean meats, and it limits added sugar and salt. I'll let Sharon talk about this in a later session, and it'll be coming up. Moving on to obesity. Obesity is a big risk factor in cardiovascular disease, and in particular, abdominal obesity. Here we're talking about the classic apple-shaped person. The chance of having cardiovascular disease is strongly associated with carrying a little bit of extra around the waist, primarily because it's a sign of having fat around your organs, which is undesirable. Men should aim for a waist circumference of less than 40 centimeters and less than 35 centimeters for women as a general marker of good health. And the last thing is your blood pressure. Now, this is the bane of many people. And the main culprit is actually salt in your diet. Now, most of us, whether we know it or not, are actually consuming more than 10 times the amount of salt that we actually need per day. Sometimes salt is easy to spot, such as the salt shaker on your dining room table. Sometimes it's not as hard. Sorry, it's not as easy. Actually, most of the salt in our diet is unseen because it comes from eating processed foods, and this accounts for over 80% of your daily salt intake. Cutting out added table salt and decreasing the amount of processed foods you eat can have a huge positive impact on your blood pressure. Now I'm going to pass it off to Sharon, who will be talking about the DASH diet a little bit more and giving you some practical tips on how to incorporate this into your life.
Thanks, Andrea. So I'll give you some ideas to help you achieve the DASH diet. So I think increasing your intake of fruits and vegetables is probably your top priority. And this can be tough because the Canada's Food Guide recommends about 8 servings of fruits and vegetables a day, but it is easy to achieve. So having fresh fruit on you on hand, like an apple, orange, or banana, is a great way to just have a last minute breakfast if you're really on a rush. And dried fruit is a good option to add to your morning yogurt. And definitely extra fiber, and it'll help you keeping you fuller longer throughout the day. And then you want to aim to have at least 50% of your meal as vegetables, because it helps with your fiber and it gets those extra vitamins and minerals in, and it's a good thing to keep in mind for lunch or dinner. And then taking vegetable sticks with hummus with you as a snack or something is a really good to go thing. And bringing fruit with you as dessert is another option, because it gets that sweet craving out of the way but helps with your nutrition. Now, the other point, if we're talking about the grains food group, is that you want to increase your intake of whole grains. And then if white rice is a staple for you, try mixing brown rice in there. And you can cook grains with sodium-free broths for added taste, and also adding herbs and spices, garlic, dill, or parsley is kind of a neat way to go. So lowering your fat in your dairy alternatives is a great thing to look out for as well. So a lot of food companies are definitely recognizing that preventing CVD is an issue, so there are more products out there for you. So definitely look at skim milk, lower fat yogurt and cheeses, and hard cheese is better than soft. And then to keep in mind that anything below 20% milk fat is considered a lower fat cheese, but you can find one as low as 7%. And then for the last food group, you want to lower your fat intake from meats and meat alternatives. So the simplest way is, if you have meat, trim off the visible fat, but then replacing meat intake with other alternatives is a really good solution. So you want to eat plenty of lentils, and they're also high in soluble soluble fiber, and this can also help with lowering your cholesterol intake and improving your lipid profiles, but also having nuts as a snack is also healthier and healthy fats that are heart healthy. So those are a couple of choices, and hope you can try that out.
Thanks for tuning in again this week.
If you missed us, please go to blogs.ubc.ca/dietetics intuition or follow us on Twitter at CITR Health, and even like us on Facebook at Dietetics Intuition. Until next time, stay happy and healthy, Vancouver.
Thank you to our team of dietetic students for that latest story on Dietetics Intuition. You can follow their blog for more info. We are going to take a quick break, but please do stay with us for your international news.
Jazz is a word that means many different things to many different people. The best definition of jazz that I know of is the jazz show on CITR with yours truly, Gavin Walker. Monday nights, 9 to midnight, with the jazz feature at 11 o'clock. Check us out every Monday.
Know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
And welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. We now go to Groundwire, our local, who have local stories and are produced locally.
Now, of course, the strike is over. We can go back to the political projects that we actually want to see happen, and that's free education.
How on earth is this going to bring wealth to any kind of First Nation community?
It doesn't make me close my eyes to wrongdoing of the Canadian government.
I'm accusing them they are behind the detention of my brothers in Egypt as well.
When another radio frequency becomes available, we actually would be able to submit another application.
It's everywhere.
Welcome to Groundwire, community radio news from coast to coast to coast.
This week's Groundwire is produced by volunteers at Kootenai Co-op Radio on Sinaik's traditional territory in Nelson, B.C.
A recent decision by the Harper government exploring the idea of granting full land ownership to First Nations communities on reserve land has reignited a debate among Canada's Indigenous peoples.
Members of the Canadian Agricultural Safety Association received a presentation this week on what nanotechnology is and the impacts it could have on Canadian farming practices.
Groundwire also explores the bigger picture and implications of the recent severing of Canada's diplomatic relations with Iran.
Yavar Hamid, counsel for Mohamed Majoub, testified recently in a reasonability hearing that evidence against Mr. Majoub was obtained by torture.
Here are the headlines.
Ontario teachers have recently started cancelling extracurriculars and voluntary activities in schools across Ontario in protest over a bill which some say radically restricts their bargaining rights. The teachers have cut the programs in protest of Bill 117, otherwise known as the Putting Student First Bill, which the Ontario government recently passed. This piece of legislation forced the teachers to adopt a new contract, which freezes wages, reduces sick days, and most controversially, prevents teachers from going on strike. The Ontario government has said that this is necessary in a time of austerity in order to trim the $45 billion debt that Ontario is facing. However, not everybody is of the same opinion, especially not the teachers. We talked to the Thames Valley head of the Elementary Teachers Federation of Ontario, Philip Mack.
We recognize the pain that's going to be there, as we have the pain in terms of not doing it, because many times that's the things we very much enjoy doing. And so it reinforces the concept that that's how punitive and how deeply betrayed we feel when, in fact, we have to withdraw the things that we are doing. The government has put the students in front of the whole, in front of themselves, and hidden behind them in terms of their programs, because they know the only thing we can do is withdraw voluntary services.
A lot of people in the Ontario media have been describing this type of action as job action and work to rule, which Max says is inaccurate, as the teachers are not currently in a strike position and won't be for another 2 years. What Mac is worried about is that in 2 years' time, when this contract comes up, they'll try similar draconian legislation.
There is in the Act itself an opportunity for the minister to continue with one more year. And in 2014, we fully expect that there's going to be far more implementation of more cutbacks and restrictions. And I think that what we find is our whole careers and the profession itself is under threat.
For Groundwire, from CHRW Radio Western in London, Ontario, I'm Ed von Attercass.
The student movement went on strike 7 months ago with the aim of winning a tuition freeze. Last week, their goal was achieved as the newly elected Parti Québécois government abolished the tuition fee hike implemented by the former Liberal government. Quebec's university tuition will remain frozen for the year, and the Parti Québécois government has promised to hold a summit to discuss the future of higher education. Along with the tuition fee hike, the controversial Bill 78, also known as Law 12, was abolished, save a few provisions concerning the scheduling of disrupted semesters at some universities and cégeps. Though the government's announcements mark a victory for the student movement, CLASS, the largest association which represented Quebec students throughout the student strike, remains critical of collaboration with the new PQ government. Executive Jeremy Bédard-Wain explains that CLASS will continue to push for the abolition of not just tuition increases, but tuition itself.
The PQ has a long history of making promises that they don't keep and are certainly no friends of any progressive social struggle. In 1996, Pauline Marois herself raised tuition and was met by a general strike of students. We cannot take a collaborative approach to her now that she's a prime minister. We had adopted a negotiating stance during the strike for a freeze. It was seen as a compromise to mobilize more easily and to perhaps win. And so it seemed like an easier objective for us. Now, of course, the strike is over. We can go back to the political projects that we actually want to see happen, and that's free education.
Marois also announced the closure of the nuclear reactor Gentilly 2, the cancellation of a $58 million loan from a government agency that would have been spent to reopen the Jeffrey Mine, Quebec's last asbestos mining operation. And Marois also spoke of her intention to replace the Liberal government's Plan Nord project with a PQ version called the Plan for Northern Development. Marois was also reported promising to introduce language legislation within 100 days and cancel a $200 annual health tax, finding the means to do so by increasing income tax for Quebec's high earners.
That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back.
And now here Here's our features.
Earlier this month, the Canadian government suspended all relations with Iran, closing the Canadian embassy in Tehran and expelling Iranian diplomats from Ottawa. But how does this move fit into the bigger picture of Iranian-Canadian relations, and what could be some of the implications?
In a statement regarding the decision to suspend relations with Iran, Foreign Affairs Minister John Baird stated that the Canadian government views Iran as the most significant threat to global peace and security today. In Baird's statement, the day relations with Iran were suspended, he provided a list of reasons behind Canada's decision. The Iranian regime is providing increasing military assistance to the Assad regime. It refuses to comply with UN resolutions pertaining to its nuclear program. It routinely threatens the existence of Israel and engages in racist, anti-Semitic rhetoric and incitement to genocide. It is among the world's worst violators of human rights, and it shelters and materially supports terrorist groups, requiring the government of Canada to formally list Iran as a state sponsor of terrorism under the Justice for Victims of Terrorism Act, read the Minister of Foreign Affairs statement. Sharzad Arshadi is a documentary filmmaker and human rights activist originally from Iran. She does not support Iran's current government, but is also critical of the motives behind Canada's latest foreign policy towards Iran.
I live in Canada because of my opposition to Iranian government. I can't go back to Iran because if I go back, for sure it's going to be dangerous for me. But it doesn't make me close my eyes to wrongdoing of the Canadian government, their reaction. They don't care for Iranian people. For me, it's only a game what they're playing now. It's not to the benefit of Iranian people.
For Arshadi, Canada's policy towards Iran is part of a larger trend of the Harper government aligning itself with American and Israeli states. She referred to incidents of the Iranian government violating human rights, such as the 2009 protests around Iran's elections, as evidence of Canada's policy choices being made for its own interests as opposed to concern for human rights.
In 2009, Iranian government was killing all these young people just asking for democracy in Iran. They were killing them on the street. They slaughtered them on the street. And Canadian government say nothing, just they didn't do anything. Constantly leave Iranian people, especially Iranian in Canada, they were asking any Canadian government for reaction. But they didn't. They were just talking here and there, but they didn't do any reaction. They didn't do any move to support Iranian people. And all of a sudden, why now? What is happening? Why? And I don't see anything except there is a bigger picture there. Their decision is very, for me, is very much related to what Israeli governments or U.S. or whatever they are asked to do.
What worries Arshadi is the potential for relations between Canada and Iran to escalate.
Only thing makes me worried is they're stepping forward to start a war. It's not going to bring anything good for Iranian people.
That was Aaron Hudson from CKUT in Montreal, reporting for Groundwire.
A recent decision by the Harper government to explore the idea of granting full land ownership to First Nations communities on reserve land has reignited a debate among Canada's Indigenous peoples as to whether departing from traditional communal land ownership may be a necessary step towards alleviating the poverty and despair that plagues many reserves across the country. Chris Reed of CKUW in Winnipeg got a hold of prominent voices on both sides of the debate to examine this venture and its potential impacts.
The First Nations Property Ownership Act initiative is legislation which is currently being tabled by the Conservative government. In a Conservative-based pre-budget report by the House of Commons Finance Committee, it would allow on-reserve First Nations band members to accumulate their own wealth and use their houses as collateral for various types of loans. Some feel that this initiative is an extension of the 1969's White Paper and is a maneuver on the part of the government to do away with the Indian Act and the guaranteed protection of the negotiated treaty rights with the Crown. Others feel that this First Nations Property Ownership Act initiative is a positive step towards a self-sustaining economic plan that would empower First Nations communities and allow for financial stability.
Joseph Cannell, I live in Lethbridge, Alberta. I'm a policy analyst with the Frontier Center for Public Policy. There's a whole host of economic reasons and political reasons why it's better that the First Nation, the local authority, controls land and the resources and the decisions around that. When the buck stops with that community, they're generally going to make better decisions about that land.
Dr. Pam Palmacher is a Mi'kmaq lawyer and blogger.
Contrary to the myths about how it's promoted, increased economic development and all that other stuff, its primary objective is to assimilate First Nations by breaking up their communities and having them sold off to allow things like Enbridge Pipeline and others to cross our territories without having to consult or respect treaties. This act is essentially the white paper reintroduced, the 1969 white paper, which would also have abolished reserves and Indians and everything that had to do with it. That's exactly what this legislation does. They don't even have the legal authority to do this. It's in violation of constitutionally protected Aboriginal and treaty rights, the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. I mean, just think about the fact that two-thirds of the reserves in this country were set up by treaties. They cannot unilaterally break up those reserves and give it to individuals without violating those treaties. It also is reminiscent of the Dawes Act in the United States, where they did just that, and it literally devastated the tribal land holdings.
I think Palmacher and others are being disingenuous when they try to compare the First Nation Property Ownership Act with the 1887 Dawes Act in the United States, because the First Nation Property Ownership Act, as it's conceived, is quite different in every respect. You know, under the FNPOA, the First Nation, it's First Nation-led and controlled, while the Dawes Act was government-led and controlled.
So let's just take an example. You know, First Nation X has 1,000 band members. They have 500 on, 500 off. And maybe they're one of the First Nations that actually have something that's called certificates of possession. I'm not sure if you know what those are, but it's a form of individual land ownership on reserve, and you can get mortgages and build businesses and build your own house and that kind of thing. You just can't sell it to non-Indians. If you want to sell it, you have to sell it to other people in your First Nation community. So imagine this act comes in, and their plan is to simply just transfer those certificates of possession into fee simple land holdings. So on most First Nations, certificates of possession are held by only a few. So let's say on your fictional First Nation that 100 people have certificates of possession. So now you have a First Nation that has 1,000 members. Only 100 get fee simple land holdings. The other 400 that live on reserve don't get anything. And the 500 that live off reserve don't get anything. How on earth is this going to bring wealth to any kind of First Nation community?
The First Nation Property Ownership Act empowers, you know, those First Nation governments to experiment with kind of some forms of unrestricted fee simple ownership. Basically, land that any individual can transfer, bequeath, sell, or lease to anyone else. Over the last couple decades, First Nations have developed tools to try to get around those restrictions, the land ownership restrictions,
uh-huh.
Designations or leaseholds. Long-term leases,
mm-hmm.
Or the First Nation Land Management Act. The problem, though, with those tools is, you know, they are much more riskier.
Darcy Bear, I'm the chief of the Whitecap Dakota First Nation, Saskatchewan, outside of Saskatoon. I guess coming from a Whitecap's perspective, we're one of the First Nations under the First Nation Land Management Act. And what that's allowed us to do is self-govern our lands. And so we've eliminated 25% of the Indian Act. When we spoke to our community members, we talked about what's important to them. Collective ownership was still important, because you got to remember that the little reservations we have today are the last remnants of our North America, because at one time as First Nations people prior to European contact, Turtle Island and North America belonged to all of us as First Nations people. So these reservations are our last remnants of that.
That piece was conceived and produced by contributor Chris Reed with the assistance of Michael Welsh from the studio at CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. In that piece, you heard Joseph Connell, Aboriginal Policy Analyst with the Frontier Center for Public Policy, Pam Palmacher, a Mi'kmaq lawyer and blogger, and Darcy Bear, Chief of the Whitecap First Nation out of Saskatchewan.
And thank you to Groundwire for that segment. We will be airing it partially once again on Friday to finish it off. Once again, that was Groundwire at groundwire.ncra.ca. We now go to our international headlines brought to you by Free Speech Radio.
Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. Russian opposition parties rejected local election results today, saying there was widespread falsification. But the ruling party says the weekend elections were clean and claims a sweeping victory in all regions. Ekaterina Danilova reports.
Monitoring experts and opposition parties reported many violations, such as ballot stuffing and organized casting of multiple votes by the same group of people. They also said media coverage and information about the election was suppressed, resulting in low voter participation. Grigory Melkonyans is the deputy director of the independent election monitoring organization GOLOS.
Most violations were connected with the rights of journalists and election observers. It's a very alarming sign because their activities were disrupted. They were not allowed to take pictures or shoot video. And that means the Election Commission didn't act openly, as it should under the law.
President Vladimir Putin said today that United Russia's victory confirms that people support the ruling party and its political cause. Opposition party officials are planning to dispute the election results in court. Ekaterina Danilova, FSRN, Russia.
The American Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit today against investment giant Morgan Stanley, alleging civil rights violations and discrimination. Morgan Stanley financed lenders who sold high-risk subprime loans by packaging them for sale to investors. The high-interest loans were heavily marketed to low-income minority borrowers. It's the first legal action brought against the Wall Street investment companies who bankrolled loans that ended up causing the U.S. economic crisis. More than 100,000 Syrians have fled into Turkey, and officials are now asking for direct help from the international community. FSRN's Jacob Resnick reports from Istanbul.
Turkey's disaster agency today reported that 100,363 Syrians have now fled to Turkey. The country's EU minister Egemen Bagish told a German newspaper that the European Union should send Turkey assistance to deal with the humanitarian crisis, despite the $250 million the EU has already pledged. Turkey refuses to classify the incoming as refugees or coordinate through international agencies like the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. That's preventing international donors from assisting Turkey, says Hugh Pope of the International Crisis Group in Istanbul.
The European Union, the United States, won't give money unless it comes through multilateral organizations like the UNHCR. The camps will have to be brought away from the border. There will have to be a demilitarization of the refugees. And all these things are things that are going to actually have to be set up in order to last for as long as the Syrian crisis goes on.
Refugee figures are even higher in Jordan, with substantial numbers also in Lebanon and Iraq. The flow continues as daily clashes between rebel fighters and the military continue in an uprising-turned-sectarian civil war that's killed more than 30,000 people over the past 19 months. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Istanbul.
Protests against Haitian President Michel Martelly continued yesterday. Hundreds of people marched in Port-au-Prince, calling the president corrupt and criticizing his failure to make good on campaign promises like easing poverty and making schools free for all. Brazilian forces moved into four favelas, or shanty towns, over the weekend to drive out drug traffickers who controlled the slums and provided public assistance to residents for years. Critics called the so-called pacification of the areas useless. Officials give advance warning of the operations, so most drug lords simply relocate on their own. Residents like Patricia Mendel tell Al Jazeera they fear the occupations in which elite forces move in with tanks and helicopters.
I'm not in favor of this police operation. We are just fine here. There is no war, no shootouts in the community. But when the police invade, everyone is frightened. The special forces police will come in and we're just here afraid.
Security forces will remain in the neighborhood, one of almost 30 areas now occupied in the run-up to the 2014 World Cup and 2016 Olympics. More than 50 protesters turned up to support tree sitters blocking construction of the Keystone XL pipeline in Winsboro, Texas today. Three people chained themselves to construction equipment. At least six people were arrested, and organizers say a 70-year-old woman was knocked to the ground by TransCanada's paid security forces. The company has hired off-duty police for security. They patrol the area around the clock and have blocked media from observing the events. This begins week four of the action to block the pipeline. Solidarity protests were held today in Austin, Boston, New York City, and Washington, D.C. Last week, TransCanada took legal action against the blockaders, asking a court to stop the protest and award damages. And former longtime Pennsylvania Senator Arlen Specter died at home yesterday. He was 82. For Free Speech Radio News from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
Thank you to FSRN for those international headlines. For more headlines and their full newscast, you can check their website at fsrn.org. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. And that's our program for today, which is Monday, October 15th. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you would like to share your comments or get involved or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. Today's show was produced by myself.
CJ.
Thank you. Tune in. Salt Rose Clapping Hands is up next. Stay tuned. This is CITR 101.9 FM.